Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the History Hit Warfare Podcast. I'm your host, James Rogers. And if it's your first time here, well, we are dedicated to military history from Napoleonic battles and Cold War confrontations to the Normandy landings and 9/11. If you like what you hear so far, if you're a regular listener, then pop over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts to drop us a 5-star review. It really helps us to get out there to everyone who loves history. Now, as you know, each week we bring you 2 new original podcasts, but once a week I like to delve into the Dan Snow's History Hit archive and pull out a podcast that needs some attention. This one is on the Battle of Britain. In June 1940, Nazi Germany overran France and forced the British Army to evacuate at Dunkirk. Severely lacking in military equipment, Britain and its empire now stood alone against Hitler's forces. But as we know, to stand a chance of crossing the Channel, Germany would have to crush the RAF. It had to gain control of the skies. This was the Battle of Britain, the first major battle to be decided entirely by air power. But what parts of this narrative have we got wrong? What parts have we got right? Well, to find out, Dan Snow spoke to historian Andy Saunders and Second World War veteran Wing Commander Thomas Neal.
Thanks very much for coming on the podcast. Good to have you at last.
Thanks for having me along.
Now, you've got heretical views, dangerous and terrifying views about the Battle of Britain, haven't you? Well, and let's start with, was it a battle?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, we all think we know what the Battle of Britain was. You know, it was fought during the summer and autumn of 1940. But really, it was a completely artificial British invention, if you want to put it that way. Churchill first came up with the term, the Battle of Britain, when he addressed the House of Commons in June 1940, and he said, the Battle of France is over. I expect the Battle of Britain is about to begin. So that was, you know, that was the Battle of Britain that is introduced to the British public and the world at large. But then, of course, when did it actually, you know, really begin? Because the Germans had carried on, well, they'd started their air assault on Britain actually in October 39. So it was really, there was just a continuation. It increased in tempo, and once they got fighters up to the up to the French coast, obviously, that was a game changer as well. But as far as the Germans were concerned, I mean, the Germans don't recognise, if you like, the Battle of Britain as such. It was just all part of the air campaign. So during, I think it was 1940, middle of 1941, the stationery office produced a little booklet on the Battle of Britain, and they set the dates of the start of the Battle of Britain as the 8th of August 1940 to the 31st of October. Completely arbitrary dates, really. Although, having said that, there was some merit in choosing the 8th of August because it was a really hard-fought day. It was the hardest-fought day of the battle up until that point. So there was merit in the 8th of August. But then along comes Lord Dowding, the former chief, or the Battle of Britain chief of RAF Fighter Command, and he is asked in 1941, actually, he was asked to produce a dispatch for the London Gazette. That wasn't actually published until 1946. But in it, he says, well, I've been thinking about this, and actually, I don't think the Battle of Britain did start on the 8th of August. I think it started on the 10th of July. And he then gives his reasons for that. And he says, well, you know, it was the day when the big German air attack started, although he admits that there were previous heavy air attacks. And what's interesting is that there was a huge air attack on the 4th of July. when Portland was really heavily bombed. HMS Foyle Bank is sunk. Seaman Jack Mantle gets a Victoria Cross, posthumous Victoria Cross. About 165, I think, sailors are killed on the Foyle Bank, which ironically was an anti-aircraft ship and gets sunk by Stukas. But RAF Fighter Command, through no fault of Fighter Command, were nowhere to be seen. They didn't get off the ground. They didn't intercept the raid. There was a failure in the radar system in that the raid wasn't detected. So really, you could argue that quite strongly that the Battle of Britain started on the 4th of July. But of course, it would have been really embarrassing for Dowding to say, well, I think it was the 4th of July, because the immediate question would be, well, where was Fighter Command? And of course, embarrassingly, they weren't there. So he sets these two dates, 10th of July to the 31st of October. 31st of October, again, is quite artificial. Certainly, the German air attacks were tailing off by that time, but they didn't stop. And there was heavy air activity on the 1st and carrying on into November, including daylight fighter activity. So you get this crazy situation where there was a chap who I interviewed many years ago, a chap called George Lott, who was a fighter pilot with 43 Squadron, flying Hurricanes. And he actually gets shot down on the 9th of July, so the day before Dowding subsequently says the battle has started. He's blinded in one eye. He's out of the war, effectively. And as he said to me, you know, nobody had told the bloody Germans that the Battle of Britain hadn't started yet. So he was denied status as a Battle of Britain pilot. And then you get squadron leader Archie McKellar, who gets shot down and killed on the 1st of November. And although he was a Battle of Britain pilot, he was not a Battle of Britain casualty. A few days later, I think on the 6th of November, there's a chap called Sergeant Adair is shot down. Interestingly, you know, Sergeant Adair is actually alphabetically the very first name that you find on the Battle of Britain roll. He gets killed on the 6th of November, and again, he's not a Battle of Britain casualty. So, you know, I just find it interesting that everyone thinks, well, you know, we know when the Battle of Britain was, but actually it was just a complete, really a sort of invention in terms of dates.
It did exist, didn't it? I mean, there was a concentrated attempt by the Germans to win air supremacy over Southeast England, right?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, nobody would doubt or question that. But it's this whole thing about when did it actually take place? And I just find it interesting that somebody arbitrarily came along, albeit, you know, somebody as revered as Lord Dowding, and says, it happened between these dates. Well, did it really? You know, it's just... And of course, on those dates also rest whether or not you qualified for the Battle of Britain clasp to your 1939-45 star. You know, so there was a huge amount of kudos that was attached to being a Battle of Britain pilot, understandably and quite rightly. But some poor guys were denied it at each end, you know.
What else do we think we know about the Battle of Britain that isn't true? For example, let's go with the, you know, German, the Luftwaffe vastly outnumbered the RAF.
Well, yes, they did. But, you know, as I think it's famously in the Battle of Britain film, you know, somebody says, well, they won't all come across at once. but yes, on frequent occasions, the RAF Fighter Command were hugely outnumbered. But, you know, numerically, if you look at a lot of the battles, yes, there was a huge disparity in the numbers involved. But, you know, they did tend to come across, for the most part, in penny packets. And sometimes German bombers were coming across almost singly, you know, to carry out low-level attacks or whatever.
They were better than us in almost every respect. The only problem they had, the Luftwaffe was not built in order to invade England. They were just built as to operate with the German army, which was perfectly good overland. It wasn't so good over the seas. So they had very short endurance periods. 39 litres would only give them about an hour and a half. So when they were in even in northern France, attacking, escorting bombers as far away as London, they would have to turn around and go back and about three-quarters way through their flight. And the red light would come on in their cockpit, which must have been very upsetting for them, because they'd be 100 miles away from base with the red light coming on. And they had their problems. And, of course, they were over enemy territory. If they conked out, and they had a lot of problems with their aircraft, really, one way or another, they would fall into the Channel before they got home. That's a lot of people in the Channel who were never spoken of.
So we shouldn't think of the RAF as it's not necessarily a David and Goliath story.
No, it wasn't always. No, you know, there's. I think there's a great deal of mythology attached to it, and I'm certainly not, you know, attempting to be revisionist, because I think it's just important to look at it, you know, retrospectively and look at it objectively in terms of what really was going on. You know, very often, although obviously we had radar and the Observer Corps and everything else, and we could get fighters pretty much in the right place at the right time, to get aircraft to altitude to actually have the height advantage, which was important. You know, on many, many occasions, if you look at the statistics, RAF Fighter Command didn't have the height advantage. They just couldn't get to altitude in time.
Give us another myth and help us understand what was actually going on.
Well, I don't know if it's so much as a myth, but one of the other interesting things, actually, which is in Dowding's dispatch, he talks about British pilots being machine gunned on their parachutes when they've bailed out over Britain. Certainly, there are instances where we know that did happen, whether it was accidental or whether it was deliberate or, you know, red mist on the part of the German pilots, I don't know. But the very interesting thing that Dowding says is that, you know, it might not have been sporting, it wasn't really cricket, but actually the Germans were perfectly entitled to shoot a British, defenceless British pilot on his parachute, because this man was going to land on home territory and he'd be free to fight the next day. However, Dowding then goes on to say, actually, the other way around, you know, it was completely wrong. British pilots should not have shot at German pilots on their parachute. I don't think they did. And as Dowding acknowledges, on both sides, there was, you know, if somebody bailed out, it was very often the case that the opponent would circle round and there would be a cheery wave. But you look at some of the combat reports of particularly some of the Polish squadrons. There's one fairly chilling report that I read quite recently where the Polish pilot concerned shoots down an ME-109 and he actually says, I saw the pilot trying to get out of the cockpit. So I shot at the cockpit and I saw the pilot collapse back into the cockpit. And sure enough, you know, if we look at the records, we can identify who that pilot was and what was happening that day, and certainly the pilot was killed. So that was a deliberate act to, you know, to kill that pilot. However, you know, this chap was a Pole. They had completely different thinking towards the Germans, and I guess a lot of them, you know, wanted revenge, so it was perhaps understandable. But there are all these little, you know, little quirky things that come out, particularly out of Dowding's dispatch, which, you know, quite fascinating.
We had a war on our hands, nobody knew anything about. And my training on the Spitfire was really nil. I could fly it. I could climb through cloud when I had to and, you know, keep up with my leader and not either lead in standing, flying past him or do things he didn't want me to do. But I was completely untouched. And there's one thing about it. I couldn't shoot to save myself. And I went up to Accrington with the rest of my squadron, which was our armament practice camp, and something like 30,000 rounds against a towed drogue or a flag or whatever it was. I didn't hit the target with one bullet.
How close did the RAF come to defeat in the summer of 1940?
I think it certainly was quite a close-run thing. But really, you know, as we know, the Germans, the Luftwaffe, you know, kept changing their tactics. And had they actually understood really that attacking the radar stations, I think the German perception was that attacking the radar stations was exceptionally difficult because they never saw any of the masts fall down, which they didn't. But what they didn't realise was that the radar stations that they did attack and put off the air, albeit temporarily, like Ventnor and Rye, I think, and possibly Dunkirk, which is Dunkirk near Canterbury, some of those radar stations were put off the air at least temporarily because the infrastructure was damaged, electric cables, you know, whatever it might be. And that would have been a game changer, because if they'd have just carried on attacking the radar stations, perhaps rather than the airfields even, then the RAF effectively would have been blind. And this, you know, that was a big part of the reason for failure, if you like, during the Battle of France, because the French Air Force, and we were flying with the French Air Force, had no command and control structure. So it was just a case of patrolling, flying up and down and hoping to find the Germans. Well, you know, that was, you know, a hopeless situation. So if we'd have been blinded in terms of the radar stations being knocked out, which would have been possible had the Germans kept at it, but they didn't really fully appreciate, you know, what damage they were doing or not doing, then that would have definitely been a big game changer.
And we should tell people, because the radar information allows vitally important, you know, pilots and Hurricane Spitfires to relax, stay on the ground, and then only actually get up in the air when they know there's a raid coming, rather than just patrolling around all day using up fuel and energy.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. But of course, the other thing about radar, which isn't generally understood, or radar then, was that it only looked outwards across the sea. So once the raiders had passed over the radar station, they were blind, you know, in terms of what the radar could see. They could only see incoming raids. So once it had passed behind the radar station, it was then reliant upon the observer corps to continue plotting the course of the German aircraft. And of course, the observer corps on some occasion lost them because of bad weather. The Germans changed course.
And these are just lots of people on the ground making notes and ringing up somewhere like RAF Uxbridge with what they can see.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was on that information, the immediate information, that the sector controllers, well, in fact, cascading down from headquarters fighter command to the group control and then down to sector stations, which were the smaller, you know, cascading down stations. It was that immediate information that was coming in from the observer corps that was all important to get the fighters in the right place at the right time. But it didn't always work. You know, it wasn't a perfect system, but it was the world's first, you know, integrated air defence system, and it was amazing for what it was.
Compare the Spitfire and Hurricane to the German fighter, the Mu-109.
Oh, that's always a difficult one. I mean, there were advantages, you know, and disadvantages with all aircraft, with all those aircraft. You know, many people think, well, the Hurricane perhaps wasn't a match for the Mu-109, but in fact it could outturn the 109. It was a match for the 109, and a lot of pilots preferred the Hurricane to the Spitfire. It was certainly a much more sturdy aircraft in terms of the damage that it could take because of its structure. Obviously, the Mu-109 had another advantage in that it had a fuel injection system as opposed to carburettors. So this meant it could go into a pretty steep dive almost immediately. That was a bit of a problem initially with the Spitfire and Hurricane. And in fact, with the Mu-109, being able to go into such a steep dive immediately, when a pilot did that, goes into a steep dive in a 109, there was usually a plume of black smoke came from the exhausts. And that resulted in a lot of RAF pilots thinking they'd actually shot him down. But in fact, all he was doing was getting out of the way a bit smartish. So, it's horses for courses, Spitfires, Hurricanes, Mu-109s. The other thing, of course, is that Hurricanes were sort of traditionally believed to be the aircraft that were sent after the bombers. But when I interviewed a fighter controller, he said, well, you know, there was a bit of a problem with it. He said that wasn't always possible because certainly from the radar traces, you couldn't tell whether it was a large formation of fighters coming over on a sweep or whether it was bombers. So actually sending Hurricanes after the bombers and Spitfires after the fighters was not always possible. So that's a bit of a myth.
And then for the 30 days of September, or throughout the Battle of Britain, I flew 141 times against the enemy, sometimes twice a day, sometimes three times a day, sometimes four times a day, even five times a day, starting at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, dawn, half an hour before dawn, going on until 11 o'clock at night. There were no union hours in your fighter command. And we lost a lot of people. Sometimes we were down to three or four aircraft at the end of the day. And we'd be replaced with aircraft by lunchtime the following day. It was a moving picture. And you were so busy with the events at hand. You were too busy to be frightened or upset. You just got on with the job. And you were apprehensive, of course, but particularly when you heard information coming over the telephone because of the radar showings on the radar screen. 50 of the enemy building up over who would carry 100, 200, 300, 400, 500. And you knew they're all heading for you. Frightening.
And how many, what about exhaustion? How many times a day might these, because I met Tom Neal said sometimes you might do 5 sorties a day, and they must have just been absolutely, the pilots themselves. What was the biggest threat? Was it lack of aircraft? Was it the pilots getting knackered? Was it the airfields themselves getting the attritional action on the airfields? Like, what was the biggest sort of choke point?
There wasn't any shortage of aircraft, really. There was plenty of aircraft. The supply of pilots coming through the chain, that was a bit of a problem, and that was why a number of pilots came in from other commands, like Bomber Command, or even from the Fleet Air Arm, were posted in. So the attrition rate amongst pilots and those that were injured or those who were physically exhausted, as you say, some pilots, you know, might have flown 4 or 5 times a day. There's one particular, well, two brothers, actually, who I've been researching recently, who were flying Hurricanes with 111 Squadron in 1940, flying from Croydon, the Fisher brothers. And so there was Anthony and Basil Fisher, and they were flying together on the same squadron. And it was a bit like, how they ended up on the same squadron, I'm not really sure. But, you know, it was perhaps as unwise as, for example, the Pels battalions in the First World War. Because these two brothers were flying side by side, and poor Basil gets shot down. His brother sees him shot down, sees his brother bail out, and actually sees his brother's parachute catch fire and watches him fall to his death. And in the squadron diary that evening, it actually says, flying officer Anthony Fisher has been sent away on sick leave with a nervous breakdown. Well, you know, hardly surprising, really. So there was a lot of nervous exhaustion, physical exhaustion, just the anxiety of waiting for that telephone to ring to go off on another scramble. It was pretty hellish.
And did Hitler help to save the RAF by, in August, well, late August, so early September, changing the focus of the German attacks from the infrastructure of the RAF to the capital city, London?
Definitely. I mean, that was a huge mistake. I mean, you know, going back to the point I was making just now about the radar stations, again, had they relentlessly attacked the airfields, then that would have, again, been a game changer. As it was, a lot of the German intelligence was faulty, and they ended up attacking a lot of airfields in the southeast that weren't really critical RAF Fighter Command airfields. And they attacked a Fleet Air Arm station at Ford. They even bombed Lim Airport to oblivion with Stukas, and there was nothing there. You know, I mean, it was occasionally used as a sort of forward landing strip, but actually it was a big wasted effort. But had the Luftwaffe really, really focused on going for the airfields, then that would have absolutely changed the game completely. Attacking London on the 7th of September was, for the Luftwaffe, or for the Germans, was a big mistake.
And suddenly I looked over the side of my aircraft, and we were all over North Weald, and the airfield had disappeared completely and utterly. The enormous clouds of black and brown smoke. They bombed about 300 bombs on the airfield. Our airfield had disappeared. And I remember thinking, oh, gosh, the city of Blighters, they bombed our airfield. How are we going to land now? And I don't remember what happened then. The bombers turned away, but were engaged by other chaps from the squadron who'd taken off separately with us. And we went down. What to do? Well, there's nothing in King's regulations that tells you what to do when your airfield has just been bombed and written out completely. And we landed, weaving between the bomb holes, like dirt track riders, hoping we'd not fall into the holes. And there were 300 or so holes on the airfield. But we took it all on our stride.
Okay, Tristan, you've got 50 seconds. Go.
Right, so Dan's given me a few seconds to sell the Ancients podcast. What is the Ancients, I hear you say? Well, it's like Dan's show, except just ancient history. We've got the groundbreaking new archaeological discoveries.
This seems to be the oldest known dated depiction of the animal world, as far as we can tell, anywhere in the world.
We've got the big names.
It's one of these great things, Pompeii. It's kind of forever rising from the dead and from destruction.
We've got the big topics.
The man destroys 7 legions in a day. No one in history has done that.
Subscribe to The Ancients from History Hit wherever you get your podcasts from. Oh, and Russell Crowe, if you're listening, we would love to have you on The Ancients. Spread the word, people. Spread the word.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And it's also true because by attacking London, it removed the ambiguity, and the commanding officers could you knew where the Germans were going to go. They were going to drive straight up the Thames Estuary, so it was easier to attack them on the way there and back.
That's absolutely right, yeah. Although they couldn't be complacent because, of course, they didn't know what the Germans were going to do next. And there was a degree of certainty, but the Germans were still occasionally carrying out random attacks here, there and everywhere. And it wasn't just London. And they did occasionally still go for airfields, but very often singly or with 2 or 3 aircraft, bomber aircraft at low level. So it wasn't entirely focused on London, but largely so.
How close did the Germans come to invading Britain in the summer of 1940?
That's a big question. I think logistically, they would have really struggled. I mean, you know, if you look at the logistics involved in D-Day, you know, I think the Germans would have struggled and most likely come a cropper, despite the fact that we got depleted defences, you know, depleted army. They still got to get across that channel. The Royal Navy was still pretty strong, well, very much so, and could have caused havoc. Certainly the Stukas might have picked off some of their capital ships, but it wouldn't have been a picnic. It wouldn't have been a walkover. Yeah, you know, the whole thing about, you know, being unprepared and on our own effectively. But I think actually, really, the German army, German forces would have absolutely struggled to invade Britain and neutralise it and actually keep a supply chain going. OK, they could have commandeered and acquired stores and equipment in the bits of the UK or Britain that they'd conquered. But I think they really would have struggled. I don't think they would have pulled it off.
Do you think they were even realistically planning for it?
Well, that's a big question, and I know historians have been arguing about that. Certainly, there were at least nominal preparations with barges and goodness knows what else being assembled on the Channel coast. But realistically, and in fact, I spoke some years ago now to the son of a senior German officer who was involved in planning Operation Sea Lion, which was going to be the invasion of Britain. And he said, you know, all the senior officers that were involved were basically saying, you know, what the hell are we doing here? This is not going to work. So there was anxiety at that sort of level. And he was a general. So, you know, he was in a position to know, and he feared that the planned invasion would be a failure.
In that case, how should we think about the Battle of Britain? How did it matter?
Well, I mean, at the time, there was certainly a real fear that the Germans were going to invade. And obviously, you know, the RAF Fighter Command had to counter the German attacks anyway. And certainly, if the Germans had wished to carry out an invasion or to attempt an invasion, then gaining air superiority was the key. So they had to do that, and they didn't achieve air superiority. Equally, the RAF didn't achieve a complete victory either. It was kind of a bit of a stalemate, you know. But the RAF victory in the Battle of Britain was certainly important on lots of levels. I mean, it was also important, I suppose, on a morale level. Although whether people in Britain at the time, you know, actually knew that the Battle of Britain was over and that we'd effectively won it, I don't know. I mean, clearly no invasion happened. But that perhaps was the only signal, only indicator to the ordinary person in Britain that there had been some measure of success. But I think it's important to, to recognise, as we do, the valour and the importance of RAF Fighter Command in those summer months in 1940. You know, whatever the period of the Battle of Britain was, you know, it's all a bit grey, you know, a bit blurred around the edges. But it was certainly a very, very important campaign.
Given that it wasn't, as you say, not sort of clear-cut victory, and I mean, the Germans failed in their attempt to either knock Britain out of the war through the use of bombing or achieve air superiority. So Britain remained in the war in control of its own airspace. So in that respect, it was a sort of Hitler's first big setback.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. It absolutely was. Absolutely no question. And it certainly must have made German high command think, and it made them realise that actually, you know, what they were taking on here with Britain was not going to be a walkover as it had been with France or, you know, some of the other countries. Although, you know, to be fair, the other countries, France and what have you, although they were overwhelmed, and certainly in the run up to the Battle of Britain and then the air war up to Dunkirk, the French Air Force, despite the fact that they didn't have a proper command and control system, I mean, they performed magnificently and actually, you know, secured a huge amount of success, despite the fact they were just patrolling up and down trying to find the Germans. But yes, for the Germans, it was certainly a salutary experience, I think. Up until that point, they'd very much had things their own way. And then suddenly, you know, they come across this obstacle. Well, the English Channel obviously was a big obstacle, but the success and the prowess, if you like, of the RAF during that summer was something that absolutely made the Germans think. And if you look at the memoirs of people or notes of people like Field Marshal Kesselring, you know, they were...
It was a German, basically air marshal, yeah.
Yeah. You know, they were astounded at the success of the RAF encountering them.
And then rather than have a Battle of Britain Mark II the following year, they decided to invade, the Soviet Union said. But, I mean, was the RAF prepared for another attempt by the Germans to win control of the skies of southern England?
There was certainly a belief that it might all sort of kick off again initially. But then, of course, British intelligence saw the Luftwaffe being gradually withdrawn from northern France and from Belgium and what have you, and directed eastwards, with the Germans just leaving effectively a defensive force in place, although there were still raids taking place against Britain. It was very much low-key. And then, of course, there was almost a Battle of Britain in reverse in 1941, because RAF Fighter Command went onto the offensive, effectively, escorting sort of penny packets, if you like, of British bombers by daylight to attack targets in northern France. The idea being to draw the the German fighters that were defending that part of the French coast up into action. And also there was a feeling that by doing that, it tied up German forces on the French coast, which might otherwise have been directed to Russia and to the east. I'm not entirely sure about that, because there were only two or three German fighter units left on the French coast. And the Germans, in any case, would not have left that coastline undefended. So I'm not sure that it actually tied them up to the extent that they otherwise would have been sent to Russia. But certainly it was interesting that there was this, as I say, a Battle of Britain almost in reverse. They were flying what were called circus operations, rodeos, roadsteads, all sorts of weird code names. The effectiveness of that is somewhat questionable. And in fact, you know, the numbers of RAF fighter pilots who were being lost in the summer of 1941 in this reverse Battle of Britain was horrendous. I mean, we were losing pilots on a daily basis, and it was different in that a British pilot who's shot down over Britain who is unwounded is, you know, he's going to fight another day, but of course he might come down on his parachute or crash land in France. He's now a prisoner, you know, so he's effectively, he might as well be dead as far as fighter command are concerned. So really, why what you might call a Battle of Britain Mark II or Battle of Britain in reverse was fought is, I think it was perhaps unwise of the RAF to have carried out the operations that they did over France at that time.
And I remember being on television with David Jason, you know, and he said, where did you sleep? And I said, well, as a matter of fact, we just slept in our clothes. We ate in our clothes between flights. And I've trained myself, I said, to sleep at every convenient time of the day. And I grabbed him by the lapels and said, is there just a possible chance? I'm not off as I'm talking to you, you see. Which raised a bit of a laugh. But that's it. We just slept between flights in our clothes. Sometimes we didn't even take our clothes off at night. Sometimes we flew in our pajamas. We did everything that was necessary at the time.
Andy, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. What's your latest? You've always got some exciting projects on the go. Just quickly tell us what you've got going on.
I'm about to take on the editorship of a brand new magazine, which is a German military history magazine. I'm running that with someone that you know well, I think, Rob Schaefer, a German military historian. The title will be called Iron Cross, but it's just having an objective look at German military history, very often through the eyes of the Germans themselves.
Thanks very much. Good luck with it all.
Thank you, Dan.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
And before you go, remember, as a Warfare listener, you get a special discount at History Hit. Subscribers get access to blissfully uninterrupted ad-free podcasts and thousands of hours of history documentaries. You've got everything from the American Revolution to my own documentaries like Traces of War, Weapons of War, and 24 Hours in Normandy, where I follow in the footsteps of the Green Howards on D-Day, from their beach landings to being awarded the Victoria Cross, and all the way through their first day where they made it 7 miles inland, further than any other British or American unit. So head over to historyhit.com/subscribe or follow the link in the show notes and use the code WARFARE to get 50% off your next 3 months. That's the code WARFARE to get 50% off. And if you're an Apple listener, you can subscribe for new ad-free episodes within the app. So give it a go. I know you're gonna love it.